this cultural exemption, to get rid of it, to expand the regulatory oversight to all truckers, and try and basically enroll these independents or so-called gypsies. Daniel Tobin, the head of the Teamsters in the 1930s, claimed that these truckers were trash, the trash on the road. And so there was definitely a tension between the Teamsters and organized drivers and these so-called independents.
I would expect that also the people who represented the railroad industry, that interest, that I also would expect would be a very powerful political lobby, that as this grew, and I suppose as it, I don't know how long it would take really to become a real challenge, but at some point I would think that they would be very unhappy about this too.
Yeah, the railroads, you know, it's interesting. In the beginning, the railroads were one of the biggest promoters in the 1920s and teens, 20s, even in the 30s. Railroads were one of the biggest promoters of the trucking industry, because at the time, you know, this is before the interstate highway system. Many rural areas really don't have reliable roads. They thought that trucks would be, you know, vehicles for getting goods to their railheads more effectively. They didn't really see railroads and trucks being competitive necessarily. But increasingly through the 1930s, it became clear that trucks, especially those that were using this agricultural exemption, were going out and gathering many of the railroad's most profitable items. Things like milk, for instance. Milk, you know, first began being delivered into major cities by express trains in the late 19th century, and it was a highly profitable line for the railroads. People were willing to pay good money for fresh, clean, refrigerated milk. By the 1930s, truckers were really taking over that business and leaving the railroads out in the cold.
Well, I'm sure that railroads are still today are involved in shipping large amounts of agricultural commodities. But at some point, if you charted this on a graph and you looked at the role that railroads played in shipping agricultural products and that trucks played, is there going to be some point where you got two lines and they're going to cross, and that the trucking is then going to start to become more important and will take the place that had been held previously by the railroads?
Yeah, the key point is in the mid-1950s, right around the time of the beginning of the construction of the interstate highway system. But even before that, the trucks were, you know, I mean, today, yes, of course, railroads still carry a lot of agricultural commodities. But by and large, the rails tend to carry low-value, big tonnage freight, like, say, grain. Whereas the truckers were hauling the higher value items like meat and milk, especially, and as I also focus on in the book, frozen foods, which were supposedly the most revolutionary idea in the history of food in the 1930s. So the trucks, even though they were hauling less in terms of tonnage over a certain number of miles, they were increasingly hauling the most profitable items. So that really hurt the railroad's bottom lines. It made it more and more difficult for the railroads to earn the profits that they had grown accustomed to earlier in the 20th century. And so that's the nature of the competition that emerged in the mid-20th century, in the 1950s especially. Railroads sensed that the truckers were getting all the valuable freight.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, just to introduce again, is Shane Hamilton. He is assistant professor of history at the University of Georgia. He's interested in 20th century American history and specifically things like agricultural and rural social history and also the history of technology. And certainly that all comes together in this story that we are talking about here this morning, a subject of his book, Trucking Country, the subtitle, The Road to America's Walmart Economy. It is published by the Princeton University Press. And as I explained, it takes a look at a number of things and how they're connected, the agricultural policies of the New Deal, the rise of the independent trucker, and perhaps also what that means for American politics today and economics today. All of that there in the book. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just also to take a step back here, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what's happening here now at this point where we're talking about, again, I'm going talking back, going back to the point of the New Deal, where you explained initially that one of the first things that the administration did, the Roosevelt administration here, in trying to address the economic problems of the country, was with a big and very complicated agricultural policy. This was, as you explained, in response to the fact that there was a depression going on in rural America, with something that really was well underway and in place before the stock market crash. And it had seemed that the attitudes of people in rural areas, at least initially, toward this kind of big government policy was positive, that they had this idea that that was going to help them, but that eventually, and maybe it actually didn't take all that long, before they started to change their ideas, and perhaps now we get to this idea where more it tends to be more the case that rural people are more conservative. They're actually believe more strongly in maybe in smaller government. They're skeptical about the idea, you know, the old joke about how the government is here to help you. What sort of role did, particularly, I guess, in New Deal ag policy play, perhaps in changing the attitudes of rural people toward government, and whether it was good or bad and what it could do for them?
Well, you know, that's the real kicker. That, you know, even today, we essentially have the basic outlines of New Deal farm policy are still in place. Along with Social Security, these are really the only two programs of major weight from the New Deal era that have continued all the way through to our own time. And so rural people, by and large, still appreciate government support. I mean, even those who are diehard libertarians, you know, refuse to believe the government can do anything good, that it's always part of the problem, not the solution, are afraid to, you know, go off of government payments, you know, that help to support the farm economy. So you've got that going along, but what I show in the book is how even as that, you know, kind of refusal in some ways to acknowledge the contradiction in their own views about big government, that continues in farm policy. In terms of other policies, particularly regulation, you know, this word that by the 1970s became a dirty, dirty word, was despised by rural people all the way through the mid-20th century.
Well, we have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'd certainly invite others here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Effingham, line number 4.
Yes, is it all right to bring some nostalgia into the conversation?
I suppose so. Go ahead.
Okay. I grew up in Terre Haute, Indiana. And the terms that your guest has been using, the milk train, and then in those days there were refrigerator cars, and hobos were supposedly opening up the tops and going in to get at the meat and frozen stuff in those. And when I were young, there weren't very many cars, and the railroad and the passenger train went right behind where I lived, the huge yards. East of where I lived, in New York Central mainly. And I guess the brings to my memory those things that growing up with that and then the understanding from adults what they were doing. The most tragic was the CNEI, which ran behind within two blocks of where I lived, a milk train. I heard you mention that, a milk train. And a returning troop train, this would have been in the 1940s, collided. And all the buzz that these soldiers had survived were on their way home, and and some were killed in that collision. You know, those tragic things, but the traffic was heavy. And finally, trucks and trucking. I trucked for 25 years on light delivery hauling mail that had formerly gone on mail trains, and then the rise of small trucking firms, UPS and FedEx and all those, which has taken, you know, a huge chunk of the mail that formerly had went on those trains and bio them with, you know, lighter trucks. But I just want to contribute that, Dave. I mean, I go back a long way, so but that was fresh in my memory as a kid, you know, and all those events and the chugging and the steam engine and all that sort of thing. It was very dramatic. Thank you very much.
Okay. I don't know if you want to comment on any of that particularly. Certainly, it says something about how things have changed.
It does, but actually, I think the nostalgia element is, we should take it quite seriously because, you know, railroads are often aspects of nostalgia. And it's very interesting, you know, this huge industrial machinery that in the late 19th century, many people envisioned as an octopus, this trust of, you know, East Coast elitist capitalists were running these railroads and, you know, potentially putting farmers' livelihoods at stake. By the 1930s, 40s, as trucks begin to replace railroads, people start to remember the railroads rather more fondly. And, you know, there's no nostalgia for truckers, although maybe that's coming out now as people are reviving the 70s and thinking about the 70s again when the trucker became the, you know, the bandit, the renegade cowboy. But the nostalgia thing, I think, is actually quite interesting.
Well, I do. I also think it's interesting that the fact that at least at some point that the trucker, that the independent trucker was elevated to the status of a popular culture hero.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's absolutely essential that, so we've been talking about farm policy and regulation. A key thing is that the, you know, the owner-operator trucker, who is the guy who ends up being hailed as a hero in the 1960s and especially the 1970s, is a product of this New Deal oversight, or lack of oversight, really, of rural truckers. So you've got a bunch of country boys, really, you know, out on the highways avoiding, you know, federal economic oversight, by and large not becoming members of unions. By the 1970s, as people, you know, outside of the trucking industry and in all kinds of social walks of life begin to mistrust the government, you know, from Watergate to Vietnam to everything else, begin sensing that the American dream is maybe somehow collapsing in the 1970s with stagflation, you know, as incomes are stagnating but prices are going up. This trucker who's, you know, not in the centers of power, whether it's in big corporations or big government or in big labor, is upheld as this kind of anti-hero in a way, both a hero and an anti-hero, because most of the truckers depicted, such as the truckers in the Smokey and the Bandit movies and in Convoy, starring Kris Kristofferson, you know, are depicted as these outlaw figures.
Mm-hmm. Well, did these people, was this a reflection that the independent trucker and the way people thought about them and the way they thought about themselves, was that a kind of a reflection of anti-union sentiment, or did that help to actually create anti-union sentiment?
You know, it's both. And it's not just sentiment. In terms of being a reflection of anti-union sentiment, yes, I think that there were, you know, many workers, whether they belonged to unions or not, many people who actually belonged to unions came to very much dislike their unions in the 1970s, including some members of the Teamsters, after their various scandals through the 50s and 60s. But one core argument I make is that these independent truckers were actually helping to transform the economy in ways that I call it the transformation to the American Walmart economy, mm-hmm. was driving down wages and driving down prices for goods at the same time. And so there's a sense in the 1970s, especially, that unions, with their high wages, you know, especially auto workers, were somehow driving up the cost of living. That, you know, unions were one of the core reasons for the stagflation that America was witnessing in the 1970s. And so long-haul truckers were lionized or heroized because they seemed to be able to point the direction to a new kind of economy where unions were no longer necessary, where hardworking folks like these truckers would help provide the goods that America wanted cheaply.
Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana, where we are, line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Professor Hamilton.
Hello.
If you could touch on the question of Dan Tobin and Farrell Dobbs in the Northern States Trucking Union and the struggle in Minneapolis and St. Paul in 1936, the Northern States Trucking Union and the Socialist Workers' Party took over the city of Minneapolis for 3 days in a general strike.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also should touch on the question of Henry A. Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the key point about the Teamsters in the 1930s, you know, really, the Teamsters Union was an older union that emerged as in the late 19th, early 20th century, organizing city deliverers, you know, small T Teamsters, deliverers of milk and bread and coal and so forth, delivering things from wholesale centers out to people's homes or to retail stores. But the 1930s, people like Farrell Dobbs took a different view. They thought, you know, why not organize anyone who drives a truck or in many ways is just involved in the transportation industry generally, the trucking industry generally, rather than focusing just on city workers. Let's try and get out into the countryside and organize all these people who are driving long haul. Daniel Tobin, who had been president for some time of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, did not like that idea. That's why he called the over-the-road truckers gypsies and trash. But Dobbs, also Jimmy Hoffa to a large extent, various other, Dave Beck was another organizer who really went out and fought hard and often literally fought hard, used strong-arm tactics to get truckers into the Teamsters Union.
I'm really interested in the fact that here we have two, as we've talked, we have two contradictory notions that on the one hand, people want cheap goods, and on the other hand, they want high wages, and that one might argue that you can't have both, but that in fact, this change in this basic transportation shipping mechanisms that we had here in this country somehow were involved in both of those things. That is, they were both somehow involved in keeping the prices. Initially, I suppose it would have been prices for food, and then maybe later prices for other kind of consumer goods, helping to keep those prices low. And at the same time, that there was some way in which they were also working in the opposite direction when it came to what people were paid for their work.
You know, it comes down to a central question, and it's a question we're facing right now, is how do you sustain the American dream? Mm-hmm. And there are different components of the American dream. Many times people think of it as the opportunity to get rich. But generally people think of it as having, you know, a secure economic situation. You know, maybe owning a home. Having a job, a steady job that isn't going to be pulled away from you at any given time. The New Deal, one of the central goals of the New Deal, if not the central goal, was to sustain that purchasing power of average American people. And there were various methods doing it. You know, supporting organized labor was a core one. Various regulatory policies aimed at stabilizing business were another. You know, even the efforts to boost farm prosperity were all about this. What we see since really the 1970s, 1980s is a sense that government should not be responsible for sustaining the American dream, that in fact businesses should be doing it. And so I show how trucking helped to actually drive that shift, that companies like Walmart, and not just Walmart, all kinds of other companies, began to take on the responsibility for keeping, you know, the American dream seemingly alive. But focusing, rather than on keeping wages high, they focused on keeping prices low. So trucking was essential to making that possible.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We'll talk with some other folks here, and let me again just introduce the guest, Shane Hamilton. He is assistant professor of history at the University of Georgia. He's particularly interested in 20th century American history and things like agricultural and rural social history and the history of technology. And all those things really come together in the story that we're trying to tell, or that he is telling here this morning. And if you'd like to read this book that deals with this, the title is Trucking Country, The Road to America's Walmart Economy, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. We have a couple of other people here ready to go to talk with us. Let's go next to the community of Belgium, and that's our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning, sirs. As a youth, I worked in the center part of the state for a farmer. And he derived a substantial portion of his income as being a trucker also. He raised grain and hogs and cattle and stuff like that, but he had also haul from rural Illinois to Peoria livestock, hogs, pigs, whatever, somebody, sheep, whatever person wanted. And he always spoke, elder, he unfortunately just passed away. He was like 97 years old, so he lived clear through this, and he was involved with this because he always had a problem with the ICC and his trucking permit, and he always spoke of times that were really rough back in the beginning. From what you said, people would strong arm him and stuff like that, and he wasn't driving a large truck. We're talking about not like a semi truck. We're talking, you know, one that was one piece, and you had to load cattle onto it. I don't know if you've ever seen what I'm talking about.
A straight
about.
Truck, yeah.
Yeah, just a straight truck. And he always talked about how difficult it was not only to deal with the government and getting his thing, but also dealing with the people who didn't want him doing this, you know what I mean? And I assume that's what you're talking about. But he just used it as a supplement to his income because the farm income wasn't enough to deal with it. He was getting pigs were paid 10 cents a pound for him at this time. This was in the early 60s. And he said he couldn't survive if it wasn't for the trucking he did. Was that a very common thing for in the Midwest here?
Extremely common, and not just in the Midwest. All throughout the country became one of the way. I mean, for many of the rural truckers who went into it, that's how they started, is it was just a sideline to their farming. You know, maybe they'd start hauling for their neighbors and then maybe make a little bit bigger business. And then they'd face a choice between, you know, going full-time into the trucking business or continuing this mix and match of farming and trucking. That's extremely common. And it is interesting, though, that, you know, the reason he was able to do that is because he had this agricultural exemption. He didn't actually have to register with the ICC. He had to follow safety rules and you know, basic regulations that he had to follow. But ICC really made it very difficult for most small firms to get into trucking. That's why it ended up being cornered by giant firms like Roadway and Yellow and Consolidated Freightways.
Well, I remember he always had to have the number on the side of his truck, and he was always complaining about them.
Yeah, he had to register and he had to pay taxes.
Oh.
He probably wasn't liking that part.
Probably not. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to another caller. This is Leroy, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think your answer to the previous question probably answers mine. My question was, you said that when the farmers were being bought out by the larger farmers, that they turned to trucking to make a decent living. And my question is kind of twofold. One is, did they make a decent living in the 30s and the 40s? And today, are independent truckers better off than they were in those days, than the beginning of independent trucking, or are they about the same? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
That's a great question. In the 30s and 40s, especially in the 30s, before regulation came in, before the Teamsters grew strong, trucking for anyone was insanely difficult and did not pay very well. It was seen as maybe a way to make a living. It was lionized in the movie They Drive by Night, a Warner Brothers film from 1940, but it was a very tough job. When the Teamsters came in, it really did help many truckers secure good pay. And through the 40s and 50s, especially, organized drivers, so-called company drivers, did very well, you know, got pensions and health benefits and other things because of their membership in the union. Independent truckers, so-called owner-operators, did okay in the 40s and 50s. In the 60s, they did exceedingly well. For various reasons, one main one being low cost of fuel and another being the interstate highway system making it possible for them to haul more loads. Owner-operator truckers did quite well. The 70s, with the fuel crisis, that all collapsed, which led to a massive uprising, several, actually, giant shutdowns by truckers who violently blockaded the nation's highways and demanded that the regulatory system be obliterated. They believed that that would help them earn a better living. And in fact, the trucking industry was deregulated in the late 1970s and early 1980s. We often remember Ronald Reagan as the great deregulator, but it was in fact Jimmy Carter that put the deregulation through. And in the wake of that, since then, long-haul trucking, independent truckers, now compose something like 400,000 of the nation's workers. They're not necessarily employees. They're often owner-operators. And some of them do okay, or some of them even do quite well. But it's an extremely risky business where, you know, you may end up getting wiped out, as many people did. Many truckers just were wiped out by the recent rise in fuel prices. So whether it's a more rewarding job today than it was in the 1960s, I guess you'd have to bring in some nostalgia. But in terms of economics, pure, you know, numbers, 1960s truckers were doing better. Owner-operator truckers were doing better than they are today.
Just, I'm curious if you compared the numbers of independents with people who work for some large trucking company, how do they compare?
In terms of numbers, today the vast majority of truckers are in so-called independents. They might work for a larger trucking company, like J.B. Hunt, for instance, which only hires, it doesn't hire employed truckers. It doesn't pay them wages. It contracts with them. FedEx does a similar thing. So most of the truckers today are so-called independents in a way, even if they actually work for a larger corporation. But the risk, the economic risk, really is they bear it rather than the bigger company.
Yeah, they own the truck. It's the FedEx is, I think probably a lot of people maybe don't realize that if you, when you become a FedEx driver, you've got to buy the truck.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they are, by doing that, they're avoiding unionization for one thing. They're avoiding having to, you know, comply with regulations on employment law and so forth. They are able to, you know, treat the drivers as small independent businessmen, which many truckers value. They value that sense of independence, but, you know, that independence is often questionable when, you know, they can't produce loads on their own. They certainly depend on FedEx to get them their loads.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else in the time that remains here. We have a caller in Aurora, line 4 right here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting topic. I used to be a trucker, and I got out of it in the 70s, early 80s, because of what you were talking about, gas prices. I actually hauled hay with somebody out west. It was kind of a co-op thing, but I know several people who still do it out west, and you're right that nowadays it's hard to be, you know, to drive an 18-wheeler no matter what. They got you regulated to the point of no return, plus, you know, if you lose a tire, or, you know, the recaps and all that, just the maintenance on your truck is just very unaffordable. But what is happening out west, I had to bring this up, is that they're turning the alfalfa fields into what I thought was interesting, because I haven't lived out there for 20 years, that they're turning them into different kinds of farming and vineyards. A lot of vineyards are popping up in the southwest desert area, and there's seems to be kind of a mini boom for trucking out there. A lot of people I've seen recently have picked up a couple number of trucks cheap and are trying to do it. I don't know if you've heard of that or not. California and Arizona. I'm just curious to see. But I know the maintenance of vehicles is just astronomical.
Right. No, I haven't. I think I have heard about some of the efforts in Arizona, but that is popping up in lots of places. And it is an interesting possibility. You know, there's this a strong local food movement coming along, really questioning the whole supermarket model of national food distribution or even global food distribution, and what role trucks would play in that. You know, it's entirely possible that trucking could go back to being more like it was in the 1930s, 40s, where it's more localized, more regional. And that, you know, we turn back to rails, which are far more efficient in terms of fuel use for shipping things all the way across country. But as of now, it certainly seems, you know, with Walmart and other companies, their distribution centers are set up in such a way that they're utterly reliant on long-haul trucks. You know, most food distribution, most agricultural distribution couldn't even go by rail today, because the centers have been built to exist on highways.
Hmm. What was that? Here we have maybe a minute or two left, but was that for big agribusiness to embrace trucking? Was that something that they had to think about, or right away did they see that that was to their advantage and that that was going to become extremely important?
It depended on the agribusiness. You know, we often don't think of supermarkets as agribusiness, but they really are essentially tied to the industrial agriculture system we have. For supermarkets and for meat packers, it was really in the 1950s, 60s, it was essential to shift to trucking because they were able to get their products delivered straight to their warehouses and straight from those warehouses then to their retail stores. And you know, I don't know if you've ever been to a supermarket that was located by a rail line, but I've never seen one.
Not that I can think of, no. Well, that's and it's interesting. You're apparently now working on a project, or have been working on a project for a while, that it eventually is going to be another book that looks at the American supermarket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, looking at this essential connection between supermarkets and the farmlands upon which they depend. And really seeing the rise of the supermarket as connected to these transformations in industrial agriculture in America in the 1930s through the 1950s, and looking at how there were efforts made to spread that model around the world.
I think I guess one of the things that interests me here is you've taken and we've just sketched it out. People can read it in greater detail, but we've taken this story where there seem to be a number of disparate parts, different elements that though come together in interesting ways to result in some really big changes in America's economy and what that means for people who work and people who have to buy food, and that maybe we don't quite always see these kinds of connections, but it takes this sort of long look back over a fairly long period of time, or maybe it actually wasn't that long. Maybe we're just talking about a few decades and we saw this kind of change happen.
Yeah, it is only a few decades, but it's a remarkable transformation. You know, in the 1930s, many Americans produced at least some of their own food. Today, very few do. You know, even farmers don't eat their own food. Everything they produce is sold to be exported out to another state, at least, if not out to the rest of the world. So it's a dramatic transformation, and I think that, you know, looking back at the history of trucking and supermarkets and really thinking about the politics and the economic changes in which they were involved, helps us to understand our own world and our own time much more effectively.
And if people would like to read more in detail of this story, look for the book Trucking Country, The Road to America's Walmart Economy. It's published by the Princeton University Press by our guest, Shane Hamilton. He is assistant professor of history at the University of Georgia. And Professor Hamilton, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy the summer studio theater production of Mitch Albom's Tuesdays with Maury, playing during June and July. More information is at KreinertCenter.com.
Well, at WILL, our success depends upon the financial support of the people we serve. The power is really in your hands. State and federal budgets aren't yet set. Who knows what support they'll provide? But right now, I'm happy to report that we are within $194,000 of having the money needed to bring you the service you expect from us in the coming year. And that's another $7,000 closer than our last report. As we work to raise the remainder by June 30th, please do what you can. Call now, 217-244-9455, or log on to willpledge.org, and thank you much. I'm Jay Pearson for Celeste Quinn again today on the Afternoon Magazine. In the 1 o'clock hour today, we will be taking another listen to Celeste's interview with Jonah Lehrer, the editor-at-large for Seed Magazine and author of How We Decide. We'll be exploring how our minds make choices and how we might make better choices. That's coming up in the 1 o'clock hour. Also, a note, our HD signal, 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3, that you listen perhaps to get AM 580 programming, will be down for a couple of hours beginning a little afternoon today so that we can make some technical upgrades that will improve reliability. AM 580 will be on the air, but it's 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 that will be off for a couple of hours while we make those adjustments. Let's take a look at the markets in Kansas City. July wheat trading at 6.05, down 10. September at 6.15, down 10 and a quarter. July at 6.30 and a half, down 10 and a quarter. July wheat in Chicago, 5.43 and three quarters, down 11 and a half. September at 5.73, down 11 and a half. And December down 11 and a half at 5.99 and a quarter. July corn, 3.84 and three quarters, down 14 and a quarter. September, 3.93, down 14 and a quarter. December, 4.05, down 14 and a half. And the July soybeans at 11.53, down 26. August at 10.92 and a quarter, down 27 and three quarters. September at 10.28,